Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Companies Editor Ian Smith. How are you doing, Ian?
Not too bad, John. How are you?
I'm wonderful. And Deputy Companies Editor Mark Robinson. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well, thanks, John. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thanks. Okay, so busy week on the results front.
Yes.
Insane week on the results front again.
26 more pages of results analyses.
Yeah, 25 next week as well, judging by the look of the latest flat plan.
Yeah, and on top of that, we've had a budget.
And we've got some interesting features in the magazine as well. The main one of which was contributed by you, was it not, Robbo?
Yes, I've been looking to the defence market, but we'll go on to that a bit later, no doubt.
Yes, we certainly will. And we're going to talk about some of the key results, but let's start with the main stories of the week, the 7 days page where we explore the wider news world.
There are a few things to say about the budget. There wasn't much in it. It was the last spring budget before it moves formally to the autumn. Obviously, Philip Hammond, Chancellor, having got rid of autumn statements.
Apparently, it was very thin.
28
measures versus 77, I think, in George Osborne's last budget.
Yeah, sure was. There wasn't that much in there. There wasn't pre-flagged. There was some extra money for social care. In terms of the stuff that affects our readers, it was probably more on the personal finance side, which I'm sure they're going to discuss on their podcast, around the cutting to tax-free dividend allowance being cut. It's only just been instated, but it was cut from £5,000 to £2,000 from 2018, which will affect investors with larger investment portfolios. So a lot of our readers
that are not held in tax wrappers.
So obviously there are things you can do, such as have a stocks and shares ISA to protect a certain amount of your investment. But worth listening and reading our personal finance content for exactly how that impacts you.
Yeah, absolutely. As Philip Hammond pointed out at the time, the new personal allowance and the increased ISA allowances actually do offset some of that. So not perhaps as disastrous as it first seems for investors, but nevertheless, a bit of a struggle for some of our readers, no doubt, with large shareholdings that are not incorporated within ISAs.
Yeah, and this was part of a wider move by Philip Hammond to increase the tax take from self-employed people and as people that have incorporated. So it's part of a wider, because of these changes to the state pension, which have equalised sort of the benefits between self-employed people and employed people, he's saying, well, we should close some of the gap in terms of how they're treated by HM Revenue. So there are reasons that kind of go into it. At the same time, there's been a big political backlash, but as you say, there are mitigating factors here.
But I think the backlash is largely because it broke a Conservative election manifesto promise, rather than the fact that this is not an unfair thing to have done.
No, exactly. So, and depending on how you look at it, this is a progressive move in some ways because it impacts on wealthier people more than it does low-income people. But at the same time, for our readers, there will be a certain impact to these that they'll have to look at. But the reason I mentioned the political backlash is not because we have a political discussion, but more because it suggests that some of this might be slightly tweaked in future. There is a chance that it might be. There's been a growing kind of momentum against some of the changes, but yeah, as I say, that's more on how it affects your personal finances.
Yeah, the care funding was interesting, and Megan has written a good piece on this because there are a number of companies involved in that sector on the UK stock market, on the London stock market. Is it going to affect them?
You would straight away think that perhaps it would be bad for them if the government was putting more money into that, that the private operators would be hurt. But actually, it's the opposite. The fact that local governments will have more money to spend on social care will benefit the private hospital groups that are going to be supplying some of that or taking up some of that slack from the public sector. So I think it's broadly been seen as positive.
So we're talking companies like Cambion and CareTech and Spire Healthcare and Circle Holdings. So, yeah, no, I think it's quite interesting. It's something that I've experienced myself firsthand. I've not been in a home, but it's something we've been looking at with my wife's dad, for example. And, yeah, there is something that needs to be resolved there. And we've had to go down the private route. There are no real public sector places available. So, yes, I think the private groups do stand to benefit from this, from my own experience.
No, exactly right. I think the only thing you'd say about this isn't a long-term solution. This is a big chunk of extra money in the short term. A green paper has been promised, which will be yet another consultation on the care system, and we had the Dilnot report previously. So there are some that are saying, well, we know what we need to do to correct some of the problems or to make up some of the shortfall. What we need to do is take those decisions. But extra money.
Some would argue as well, given the demographics, that the problem's virtually intractable.
Yes, and it's one where the problem before has been partisanship amongst in Westminster, whereas actually now there is cross-party consensus this needs to be dealt with. But I don't think anyone saw the changes here as dealing with it yet, but we'll wait and see what's in the Green Paper. But extra money has been welcomed, and yeah, and the companies that operate in this space do stand to benefit.
Yeah, I think it's a discussion that needs to be held for another time, because it is a complicated one. Business rates, there'd obviously been some concern about the big jump in business rates that's about to come in because of the increase in rateable values. And there were some measures to address that. This would affect many companies on the UK stock market.
Yeah, many. But I think with a lot of the easements that they're putting in, that's the smaller operators. So, yeah, we saw certain exemptions, certain caps put in place to try and limit the impact. There was quite a big backlash from the smaller business lobby against these changes because they are dealing with a number of challenges. There was also some good news for pubs. They'll get a discount. Those pubs with a rateable value of less than £100,000, which I think the vast majority of smaller operators will receive a discount. Although some of them see it as a discount on something that's actually been increased, so perhaps not as welcome in overall terms.
Well, like the care issue itself, there's an underlying issue here, and that's structural changes to the retail market as well. And so this is effectively another holding position which will sort of play out over time.
And that's something that the Chancellor did refer to, retailers that don't have bricks and mortars operations having a structural benefit here, as you say, Mark. So that's something we might be able to expect in future, that the government is going to be paying attention to the the e-tailers and how the kind of level of tax and burden they are taking versus the bricks and mortar operators.
Just how long has the British High Street been dying for now?
Forever, just like the NHS.
Yeah.
There you go. Right, let's move on. Standard Life Aberdeen. You've written about this in your Taking Stock column. It's the lead news story. It's on 7 days. Let's talk about what's going on there.
Yeah, so Standard Life, one of the major life assurers, which has actually in recent times become a more of an asset manager itself, has a big asset management arm, is going to be merging with Aberdeen Asset Management.
It looks like a done deal, is it?
It looks fairly like a done deal. The major shareholders in Aberdeen support it. Both share prices went up on the deal. The argument for it is that there's been a rush to scale amongst the active asset managers.
And this is really to overcome the challenge from the passive industry, one assumes.
Exactly. So we had Janus Henderson, that was the big merger last year. And this is even bigger, create a huge active manager, one of the biggest in Europe, with actually a lot of complementary business lines. So Standard Life has a good retail channel via IFAs. Aberdeen has good institutional ties. There's lots of complementary sides to these businesses in terms of the areas where they invest. Aberdeen being an emerging markets biased fund manager, which has hurt it in recent times. So there's lots of arguments for it and synergies, which will be politically unappealing in some respects because they will involve a lot of job cuts. At the same time, there are clear synergies from merging platforms and so on. The argument against it, I suppose, from a Standard Life shareholder's perspective, and I got into that a little bit in my column, would be that you are creating a business that is ever more cyclical. You're tying your fortunes to active management and saying this tie-up demonstrates our commitment to being one of the leading active managers. But as you say, the threat from passive is huge, and the threat from clients wanting to control the only thing they can control, which is the cost they actually spend on their investments, might mean that if we look at this in 5-10 years, if this goes through, will Standard Life be happy that the business has moved away from its traditional life insurance business so much to becoming an asset manager that goes with the swings of the market? That's a bigger question. The other related question, I suppose, is Aberdeen Asset Management the best company to tie up with? It has its own problems. It's been dealing with a lot of outflows from its emerging market funds, which are its major funds. So there's been a lot of positive reaction to the merger. There's obvious financial synergies. But in terms of what it means strategically for Standard Life as a business, we'll see whether it creates a stronger business with time.
Yeah, I mean, my view on active managers and scale and the benefits that would bring is not necessarily to pool money, because large funds tend to act like tracker funds anyway, but would be to just generally enable them to reduce the cost of the cost of the end investor of owning actively managed funds to the point where they become a little bit more competitive with passive. And I assume that's the thinking here.
Yeah, and I'd agree that would be a good approach. I mean, multi-asset is an area where Standard Life Investments has been hugely successful with its GARS fund, although in very recent times, some of that has reversed. But yeah, if you can get active management towards more of a lower priced commodity that private investors and institutional investors can pick up, then yeah, you can stave off some of that impact of the passive managers, which still only make up a certain amount of the market. They aren't not all conquering. It's just if you look at where the growth is.
Yeah, I mean, certainly among the funds that we like, you know, some of the best funds, according to our readers, have very, very low management fees already in the investment trust.
And transparency is an issue as well. But I believe legislation has been introduced over the last few years to improve that.
Yeah.
And there's also the
cost.
Time.
Cost is a big issue, though.
Cost is a big issue. And everyone's looking at the strength of passive at the moment. But let's not forget we're at a time where equity markets are all-time highs.
Yeah, so passive funds look good, don't they? I mean, they've done well. But not in and of themselves, but because the markets have done well.
Exactly.
What happens when that reverses?
Yeah, what happens when that reverses, which is what active managers say, which is we will demonstrate
I think
our value.
Too. I think they're absolutely right. I think the active my personal view, that the active management industry has been somewhat unfairly disparaged as a homogenous whole, when actually there are very, very interesting pockets within it that do prove their worth year after year after year. And the debate has been oversimplified.
Yeah, exactly right.
Okay, right. What else we've got on the news pages? 7 days, we have... So, more concerns around the car industry with the takeover of Vauxhall Opel by General Motors.
Although I was just looking at Looker's results, actually, and that's been quite strong, the new car market for them. So, yeah, it does depend which area you're in, which clients you have. They've got a good fleet division as well. Yeah, there are still worries about this, and it reflects in the valuations that are being put on the motor retailers at present.
Mm. And we don't have any motor manufacturers, as I talk about in my column, my editorial this week, but the automotive industry is important in the UK throughout the value chain, from retail through to manufacturing.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, what's interesting about this deal is the effect that it may have on GM over in the States as well, because it effectively removes two loss-making segments of the business. And it reduces their exposure to euro risk, Brexit, also any legislation that might follow in the wake of the VW emissions scandal. It frees up capital for them as well. It feeds into their new strategy, which is rather than aiming to be the largest car manufacturer in the world, being the best, you know, concentrating on those parts of the business that are the most profitable. Looking at return on capital and return to shareholders as well. All of these are stated objectives, GM, and they may have actually got the monkey off their back with this deal.
Do you think that by the same token, you could question how valuable this deal will be for PSA? It gives them, you know, the second biggest business in Europe, but is that necessarily a sine qua non?
Well, exactly. I mean, I'm not quite actually sure what happened to the share price, bearing in mind as well that it's still state controlled. But the incentive from their perspective seemed a little bit more obscure.
Cost-cutting, isn't it?
Well,
which is why there's concerns about jobs in the UK.
Well, yeah, so that was one of it as well. But it still seems to me, what was the point of buying up two loss-making arms that have tried to restructure in recent years, but to no avail? So
just ahead of a major break in terms of the supply chain or, the trading relationship between the two parts of the business.
Yeah, there's that as well. And plus, I think they've taken on $2.5 billion in unfunded pension deficit as well, so commitments rather. So I mean, that's an interesting part of the deal too. So from the French perspective, it's difficult to see what the incentive was.
Scale.
Yeah. It's all scale.
Yeah. So I noticed actually looking on 7 days page, the numbers: 23.9 billion value of domestic M&A deals completed in the UK in 2016, highest level since 2008. So deals. This is where we are right now.
Yeah. And some people think that's because of the value of sterling fallen, that you've seen more of that activity, but then obviously we've had some really even bigger deals rebuffed.
Yeah, some suggest this is a kind of end of cycle behaviour, that when the growth is becoming that much harder to come by, you buy.
Yeah, and it was exactly right. And yeah, I got that into that a little bit in my profit concentration feature last year, this ever-increasing rush for scale, and you can see that in a few different sectors currently.
Okay. One other interesting news story this week, Shawbrook, the Challenger Bank, which itself was subjected to a takeover rumour, approach,
which it has rebuffed from its largest shareholder, Pollen Street Capital Partners. So, yeah, they came with an offer, they increased the offer, and then they were pushed back. The business thinks that it undervalues them, they can get more value themselves. That we actually have results from Shawbrook this week.
And Aldermore as well, another Challenger Bank as well.
Yeah, results from Aldermore as well. Yeah, on the Shawbrook side, they had some problems last year where they had asset finance business that was written outside of their loan criteria, which is a euphemism for just bad loans. So they had some issues there. They had a big surge in their buy-to-let lending business ahead of the stamp duty changes, as you'd expect, but then things died away after that. But generally, the overall loan book growth was good, so you can see why management think that the best way to grow this business is organically, with their hand on the tiller.
Similar story at Aldermore?
Yeah, similar story at Aldermore. The buy-to-let lending was a big boost, but obviously with the imposition of the higher stamp duty, that really slowed down that market. So we're yet to get a sense of, you know, post that increase in tax for secondary properties, is this still going to be such a strong market? The argument that it will be such a strong market over the long term is the structural shift towards renting that doesn't show any signs of slowing.
Mm-hmm. And we had Metro Bank results as well, didn't we? Everyone's favourite little new high street bank. They looked okay too.
Yeah, it's the same continuing story at Metro Bank, which is that it's a very high cost growth model that they have, doing the opposite of what everyone else is doing in the industry, growing their branches, costly branches, putting every bit of focus on customer service. And actually, we have a podcast where Emma Powell, our banking correspondent, a special podcast, has interviewed the CEO of Metro Bank, so you can find that on Acast. But yeah, they have a high growth model. It does seem to be working, but they are struggling, like all retail banks that we've seen through this reporting season. They are struggling with the lower interest rate, which is suppressing their net interest margin. So it's not a great time to be in retail banking.
No, but the losses are shrinking.
The losses are shrinking, and the top line is growing.
So that's good.
That is good.
So we're moving in the right direction there.
But they are quite highly valued too. So the call is whether you think that they are going to be able to generate enough profit.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, lots more on the results front. Let's come back to results in a jiffy. Actually, before we do that, I mean, you mentioned Emma's Metro Bank podcast on Acast. We have another very interesting podcast on Acast this week, which is James Norrington's interview with Nobel laureate Robert Shiller on the narratives of investing. It's fascinating. Have a listen. Robert Shiller is a man to be listened to. And basically, his story is that we have to be very careful about the stories we are told when making investment decisions. But go on to the podcast and listen to that in more detail. Mark, let's talk about the arms industry, because that is the subject of the cover feature this week. It's a fascinating subject. Certainly lots going on geopolitically that would suggest that this is an industry you need exposure to right now.
Well, yes, it's not just the global security situation, parlous as that may seem to many people, but it's also linked with technological change and also political change, most famously, of course, in the United States with Donald Trump.
Let's start there, because the US has always been the world's biggest spender on defence.
Exactly.
And Donald Trump wants them to spend more.
The world's biggest customer, the world's biggest producer, and Donald Trump is looking to boost the overall Pentagon budget by, I think, $54 billion over the coming year. A fair portion of that, I think about two-thirds of that, had already been proposed by his predecessor Barack Obama. But still, it's a near 10% rise in absolute terms, which is was huge given the Pentagon budget itself. And I think it's the largest year-on-year rise since the first year of the Reagan administration. And I think Reagan only really managed the highest rate he ever managed was 14% in 1 year. So it's pretty hefty.
Either way, there's going to be more money going towards defence there.
Well, yes, almost certainly, given that two-thirds of the increase had been proposed by the Democratic administration previously. That should ease its passage through Congress.
Do we know where it's going?
Well, no, I certainly don't know where it's going at the moment.
Do we have any ideas where it might be going? What kind of areas will they be spending more money on?
Well, certainly one area where not just the US but the UK and European governments are clamouring is cyber security. I mean, that's come to light again as a result of the US election as well, and allegations that that the electoral process itself had been undermined by Russian efforts in cyberspace. Whether that's true or not, we don't know at this stage. But
I don't think we ever will either, but there you go.
Well, possibly not, but it just highlights that this is a real growth area in defence markets as well. I mean, in many respects, the defence sector has lagged the private sector in this regard, because any of us who use online banking or any other form of digitalized commerce will know that that's a very big part of the private industry now.
It is, and this is something you mention, and in fact something that what you would usually consider to be very defence-focused groups are actually increasingly looking at is actually what they can sell to the private sector.
Well, yeah, BAE Systems, most famously, they have a lead technology role in cyber defence.
Well, they bought a company many years back called Detica.
Yeah.
And Detica was kind of 50-50.
Well, exactly. But they, in just over the last 18 months, 2 years, they've pushed harder and harder to get into the private sector, because obviously that's where consistently you're going to be able to generate revenues. There's the other area that I pointed to as well is unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, for want of a better term. Again, this is one of the areas which is being looked at very hard by the military at the moment for a number of strategic reasons, but underlying it all is the fact that the cost associated with generating modern jet fighters. Most famously, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program has run over budget. It was
This is one that Trump threatened to cancel.
Yeah, he was one of his in one of his tweet fests. He threatened to cancel, curtail, or shrink the program during the election campaign proper. But even at that stage, I believe that Lockheed Martin, BAE, and a number of the other contractors were saying that costs were actually coming down because of scale benefits. They're actually managed to get sales proceeds from more and more of these aircraft. And so there was a bit of a lag. It's still prohibitively expensive, though, and so BAE have been developing the Taranis drone.
Which is what we've got on the cover.
Which has been dubbed by aviation experts as the most advanced plane ever to be developed in this country. And it's providing essentially a prototype at the moment, but it's providing, we're trying to find exactly what is technically capable for this type of unmanned aerial vehicle at the moment. And when I spoke to BAE, they couldn't obviously say anything about it, couldn't give any detail whatsoever, but it's generally held that this can travel at supersonic speeds. It's virtually undetectable to radar, and it can independently pick out targets in the field, which is fairly frightening in a way.
It sounds terrifying.
And it sounds
like a Cylon from Battlestar Galactica. It looks a bit like a Cylon from Battlestar Galactica.
Well, it is the stuff of science fiction, really, but as I say, BAE loathe or unable to comment at this stage, and it's feeding into a larger European project involving some of the large defence contractors France and Italy as well.
It already involves some UK contractors as well. So we talk Kinetic.
Yeah, they're all feeding into at the moment. Rolls-Royce. Obviously. So they're all, with any large-scale project like this, it's invariably a concerted effort just because of the technological challenges.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I will say, I mean, some of the defence contractors that are listed in London have not exactly been having a wonderful time recently. Cobham, for example, has had a number of profit warnings. I mean, is this the turning point for those sort of businesses?
Well, it was interesting when I was looking at it as well, because obviously, for the sake of our readership, we were looking at valuations above anything else, and the stock of a number of defence companies have been rising since the early part of last year, Cobham being an exception there. But the valuations at the moment, while I say they're not overly stretched, when you look at those growth projections in the market, it's still, you know, the value isn't absolutely compelling at this time. I do point out companies like BAE and General Dynamics, when you're putting a portfolio together, they would be worthwhile because they are a sufficient scale, back to that word scale again, and breadth of their operational activities, that they would capture most of that growth in, well, the growth in those areas that I've mentioned, but also they feed heavily into existing US and European defence contracts. So they stand to benefit even over the long term.
I mean, you talk about some other smaller UK contractors here, Ultra Electronics being one. It's in the table, it's not in the feature, but it's in the results section.
Yeah, I didn't cover it. I didn't cover it this way. Alex Newman did, but he told me they were pretty good on the face of it.
It's an interesting company. Lots and lots of capabilities, lots of specialist technical niches that it's in.
Yeah. This is
what I always liked.
I mean, you're talking about... we're reaching a stage now where companies reaching the end of the cycle and consolidation is a part of a number of sectors. It normally is a part of aerospace and defence, so you know, it's possibly we could see some activity in the coming months.
Cobham had a not very good set of results, obviously, with the rights issue. They are quite a good example of having a very good product, but then kind of suffering for it. It's what kind of lessons can investors learn from Cobham's experience with air refueling?
I point to the nature of defence contracting, and that's changed in recent years. But unfortunately, you get certain types of contracts that aren't open to tender, that are agreed up front with the MOD or whatever defence department it happens to be. And this often leads to incorrect pricing at the outset. It's not dissimilar to some of the oil services companies as well, when they've got these long-dated capital-intensive projects. Very difficult to price them at the beginning of any the outset of any project accurately. So Cobham, unfortunately, has got this legacy contract which is linked to in-flight refueling, which is odd, really, given that the company was actually a pioneer in this area. But that's really dragged on profitability over the last 3 years. And there's no end in sight at the moment, so I believe.
No, anyway, thank you, Mark. It's a cracking feature. It's not just obviously the US that's going to be spending. Trump is obviously putting pressure on some of the NATO partners in Europe to spend more.
Yeah, that's been well covered in the press.
Covered.
I mean, but I guess it's a bit of tub thumping on his part as well to increase the political profile of that issue.
True. Plenty of European companies, though, that would like to see that happen, that you mentioned in the feature, Dassault being one of them, excuse the pronunciation, Finmeccanica, Finmeccanica. So very, very interesting and capable companies over in Europe as well that are definitely worth a look. Okay. It's interesting you actually mentioned mispricing of contracts, because one of the results this week was G4S, which has had its problems with large contracts over the past few years. Turnaround evidence there, looking very good. Ian, what else have you noticed on the results front that really caught your eye this week?
In this week's issue, we have LSE's results write-up, a long analysis of that. And if you leave aside the merger, which we discussed at length last week, things are going really well. The indices business that you mentioned last week.
Oh, that old chestnut. Yeah. Making a lot of money, is it?
It's making,
funny, that.
Surprise, surprise, a lot of money. And that whole division is doing really well. The clearing business, which you also mentioned last week, is being important to them, and they're not wanting to lose parts of that in any geographies. That did well over 2016 as well, the over-the-counter clearing of derivative transactions, which is a huge area for banks. That is performing really well. So it's as well, which is the continuation of some of the trends we've seen in previous years. But LSE is in good shape. I suppose one of the concerns is looking at the primary markets, for example, the amount of new issues for the main market was well down in 2015. We've just had this software group, Mysis, fail to come to the market in the UK.
Mysis? come back
as discussed, and it might be that people are drawing on their past experience, but I saw a story saying that the FT was reporting that MISIS might be considering a US listing. Now that would be interesting if London is starting to lose, or does start to lose, listings of major companies to the US, perhaps due to pre-Brexit uncertainty, or perhaps because they don't think it's as good a market for tech listings as the US.
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean, this week you've had Snapchat, obviously, which took off.
And no one can blame IPO. Yeah, no one can blame London investors for being more discerning when it comes to.
No, I think that may be something to do with it. I think London investors may ask a few more questions, and because of that, these kind of tech businesses might not get the valuation they want.
Yes. The bigger question then is, you know, London as a central financial centre is the second biggest financial centre in the world. Its place, people will be very much looking at the primary markets and the health of those in 2017 and comparing them to New York and the other major markets to see whether there has been a drop-off in issuance. That pattern I don't think has yet been established, but it definitely is front of mind for a lot of people that look at the market. But otherwise, LSE, which that is just one part of what it does, it is trading well.
Yeah, largely thanks to its information business.
A big part of it. It's all information.
Okay, so LSE looking good, regardless of whether or not the merger goes ahead or the merger with anyone else goes ahead. So, Robert, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, it's a specialty chemical company that I've been looking at for a while from a value angle. It's Elementis.
Elementis, my dear Robert.
Elementis. And what's interesting about the company is that their expansion into growth markets in Asia. There's a structural story here. Obviously, as median incomes rise in Southeast Asia, more and more people are buying personal care products.
These are chemicals for cosmetics, basically.
Well, exactly. They're propellants and things to make perfumes, you name it. Anything that goes into the stuff that you'd have in your bathroom cabinet at home. And of course, it's things that we in the West take for granted, and they've become consumer staples. That hasn't always been the case in Asian economies, but as median incomes rise, they suddenly become desirable items, the ones that you need every week. And the subsidiary company, Summit Rehas, that Elementis acquired is the largest producer into that market, and the growth has been significant over the last 18 months, but its projections for that area of the business, which are really buoying the share price at the moment.
Indeed, it's had a good run after we suggested buying it, but you've lost your bottle, haven't you?
Yes, I got a ticking off from Algy Hall on this as well. But I just think, well, as usual, but I just thought the ratings at the moment is very difficult to turn around. I think, you know, if you're going to hold on to it for a long-term investment, there's every reason that you could come in at the present level. But given its relative multiples at the moment, I slunk out of the room with a tail between my legs. Not for the first time.
It does stay. It's interesting as a kind of UK exporter in the sense that it does suffer from dollar strength, right? Because it manufactures a lot of its chemicals in North America and then sells them around the world. So that's an interesting kind of FX angle for the readers.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of other companies this week as well where we've had the converse story with sterling weakness, if you like. We've had a couple of manufacturers complain about input costs.
Yeah, I my view, generally speaking, is that the sterling story, the FX story, is often paid far too much attention.
Yeah.
Because it fluctuates.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's good one year might be different the next, both in terms of the rate and in terms of how the business is structured. Attention to this.
Well, I mean, it's significant from the income front. You know, it increases.
Assuming it's a transactional cost rather than a translational one.
Yes.
But we've written about this plenty of times before. We don't need to talk about it now. Should we talk about Convatec? Because that's the story we picked out as the good week. Biggest float of the year last year, talking to the IPO market. And it's been a good one.
Yeah, it's been really good.
For investors.
really good for investors. If you don't know much about Convatec, its operations quite clear from the four franchises that it operates: wound care, ostomy as in colostomy bags, continence and infusion. So plenty of great products there, but obviously all very important.
All very important. Actually ties quite neatly in with the long-term care story that we were discussing right at the beginning of this podcast. It's the same trends that will be driving this business.
Exactly right. And some of these markets are really fast growing or expected to grow quite quickly. Ostomy, for example, is currently it's supposed to grow at a maximum rate of 6% a year until 2020, the total addressable market.
That's a terrifying prospect for someone getting old.
Yeah, that is terrifying, but these aging dynamics are here to stay. And they bought a Netherlands based company in that sector, Eurotech, which is helping them. Yeah, they're growing. As any company that comes from private equity background, you have to have one eye on the debt. But
which looking at that ratio is pretty chunky, that gearing ratio.
Yeah, it's pretty chunky, but at the same time, it's a business that's generating a lot of cash. Mm-hmm. And once the one-off costs and charges to do with the IPO kind of fall into the background, then we'll better get a better picture of the profitability of the business. But it's definitely in growing markets. It has some important specialisms and things that are increasingly needed. So if you wanted to make a kind of structural long-term argument, you could. But then there's a pretty hefty rating on it too. It's more expensive than its closest peer, which is not exactly the same kind of business as it, but still, you know, as close as you can get, probably Smith & Nephew. So it trades a premium to Smith & Nephew.
Which makes artificial joints.
Exactly.
I must admit, I upset my mum. My mum had a double knee replacement recently, and I was like, how you doing, mum? Went to visit. How you doing, mum? Yeah, I'm good. Where'd you get your knees from then?
Never takes a day off.
Indeed.
Exactly right. So slightly different products, but they're doing well. Yeah, and what else do we have? GoCompare had a good boost to their revenues, but like with all the price comparison websites, the marketing costs are really high on that one. So GeoComparo, who you might have seen singing on a gondola in Venice.
Try not to.
Try and ignore it. It seems to be pulling in the punters for that.
All right. Well, we're running out of time. We've got about 65 more results in the magazine.
And we're going to go through every single one.
And yeah, so get yourself a cup of tea. We'll be here for the next 3.5 hours. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to let you read them at your leisure in the magazine. Robbo, you wanted to say something, didn't you?
Well, no, I was just going to, when I covered Pure Circle, might be of interest to
Is that, that's not
well.
Because they sent us a bag of they non-sugar. Did,
which we disposed of straight away. Well, it's just that they had effectively an import ban into the United States, which was overturned in the early part of this year.
It was even before Trump got his hands on it.
Exactly. But anyway, it was good news for them, and we're looking at the share price performance. They did make the point, however, it would take them some time before that business recovers to its former momentum.
Just a word of advice to Pure Circle's PR. In future, don't send us some sugar cubes. Send us some products, proper products that have some, like chocolate or something like that.
Get rid of that one, Dom.
Yeah, anyway, right. Okay, so thank you very much. There's lots more in the magazine this week. It is an absolutely mammoth issue. The usual tips, as I said, another 20-odd pages of results there. Lots and lots in the personal finance fun section, which they will no doubt be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. We have SharePad's Phil Oakley back talking about how to avoid value traps. Fantastic feature. The second in the current SharePad series. Definitely worth a look. John Barron is in the magazine this week, also talking about value. In fact, there's another article about value in the fun section. Value. Yeah. It's all about value right now. Which I think we've actually spoken about for quite some time. Lots in the comment section as usual, and actually even more news than we've had time to discuss. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ian. Pick up the magazine in all good newsagents, £4.90, or get online and subscribe. And if you like this podcast and don't want to miss any future podcasts that we might do, then you can subscribe at acast.com/investors chronicle, and you'll find all of our previous shows, all of the personal finance shows, and all of the standalone podcasts we do, including the Metro Bank podcast I told you about earlier and the Sheila podcast that I mentioned that we did this week. And you've got to also find us on iTunes, where you can actually give us a rating and review us if you wish to do so. 5 stars, please. Anyway, thank you all very much, and we'll be back next week. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.